Welcome to It Shipped That Way, where we talk to product leaders about the lessons they've learned helping build great products and teams. I'm Alan Pike. Our guest today is veteran product designer Brad Ellis, who has worked at Square, Airbnb, Lyft, just to name a few. And I always love chatting with him about the joys and pains of product design. So I'm thrilled to welcome Brad.
Hi, Alan.
I want to dig into all sorts of fun stuff with you, talking about building stuff and all the foibles in doing that. But a nice place to start is always to give people some context on where you're coming from. What you've seen is the origin story, the origin of Brad Ellis. And as I understand it, your first big gig, not your first gig at all, but your first big gig was at Square. But it wasn't so big at the time. How big was Square's product design team when you joined?
I was the first designer they hired. They had a designer on sort of the founding team. Mm-hmm. And then I was the first one after that. So I think I got hired and then I started 2 months later. So by the time I started, I was employee 42, the magic number.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And you were basically the design side was the you and this founder, or probably I would imagine only a percentage of the founder's time, because if you're a founder, you probably have things to do other than
He was another. They had two founders, and then they had that founding team. You know, what are the six people
right.
or whatever that got it off the ground? And so one of those guys, his name was Robert Anderson, and still does some contracting work for them. And he had worked on MobileMe before that. Before turning
yes.
into iCloud. It was only MobileMe for, a year in there?
And it was .Mac before that, I think.
Oh, yes. Oh, exactly. iTools, all sorts of things.
Yeah.
He had worked on that, and then, so he was doing full-time, and then I was the first designer they hired in to sort of be like, okay, now we got to make a team. And then I was the manager of that team, and then helped scale that up to 10 from there, before I got out of there.
Before you got out. But and that's pretty rapid growth. You're there for 2 or 3 years and getting, sort of going from you're the first hire in outside the founding team to the running a team of 10 designers.
I started at 42, and then a year and a half later, we were at 340.
Oh, wow.
And so it took a year. It was an insane amount of growth, and just very interesting to be like every time, we were doing, I don't remember what our cadence was at. This is sort of before the agile 2 week style. I think we were doing 4 week maybe. But every release you have two or three new people on the build every single time. And so the amount of turmoil, it felt like most of our energy was just sort of hugging ourselves together as we move desks and have to reorg constantly sort of because we need to, And
yeah.
So it was an interesting time for sure.
Yeah, people will debate sometimes about what hyper growth is. Is it 100% a year? Is it 50% a year? Is it 200% a year in terms of team count? And obviously, the faster you're growing, the more growing pains and problems you have. But I would say that growth rate that you're describing is way beyond any threshold for hyper growth.
Absolutely. And also, there's hyper growth in in different departments too, right? So is it that your support team is growing crazy? Mm-hmm. Or is it that your engineering team, where are those people being added? Are you scaling up marketing? And if in that time, at Square, we actually, the COO had a cap on the number of support people.
Okay.
Because he was like, if I don't just let this run wild, then we'll have three floors of support.
Right.
We have to sort of figure out how we're going to, scale better as our business scales. It can't be, what we're doing here. But before that, I was up in Seattle.
Right.
So that was sort of my, that was where I grew up, where I got my first start. I worked at the Apple store when I was in college.
That seems like a part of a lot of people in that, in your generation or our generation's origin story is that Apple store is a really great first gig for a smart product oriented person that doesn't yet have the resume that will get them hired on at a Square or something.
Yeah, fourth year that the Apple stores had been open. So they were still figuring some things out, making some changes. While I was there, I did theater presentations.
Nice.
And I did 1 hour trainings with people. That was my gig. I was called a creative. I don't know if they have different names for them now, but it was super interesting. So I worked there for the Intel transition.
Mm-hmm.
A little bit for the iPhone before I got out of there at the Apple store. And what was very interesting was helping people unbox their first computer.
Ah.
And this would be 2006, right? And they're like, what the hell is this thing? What do all these buttons do? So sort of showing them, here's the paradigms of a computer. Here's the mouse. Oh, not that way. Actually, it's this way,
Mm-hmm.
As they go through that and sort of learning sort of all these pitfalls, what do people need to learn? And so through that hour, I'm sort of making a dynamic lesson plan based on what they're interested in.
And what their capabilities are.
Absolutely. And sort of adjusting to that, because there's so many ways to do things on a computer. So what are you interested in? Okay, there was one lady I worked with. She was like, I love I want to really capture my recipes. So I bought a printer and I bought a computer and I'm going to write all my recipes down so they're nice and legible so I can pass those down. So I was showing her here, you know, here's text edit. Here's how we format some things. Let's, you know, figure out how your recipe should look and M dashes and all that kind of stuff. And then I got to the end and I was like, and here's how we save files. I was going to, you know, take her into that part of the system. And she's like, I'm not going to do that. You know, no, that's too much.
I'm just going to run the computer. It's just going to run forever.
I'm going to print them off and then I'm going to close the document and I'm not going to save. And so Ray looked very interesting. She's like, I don't, why would I need to save it? Just very interesting, right? But helping people with that, it was, what was interesting was how staggeringly complicated so many things were. You know, just like, here's iTunes. Let me just point to all the pieces of UI around here for things you want to do.
Oh,
right?
Man.
And so the difference then when the iPhone came out and I was doing the same thing, it was so much easier to explain and people got
right.
it so much faster. Just because it didn't have, I don't know, all this like legacy cruft. You didn't have to understand as much about how it worked.
You don't have to save the file and know where it was being saved. And the person who's like, I'm not going to save, you don't have to have that conversation.
Well, yeah, they too bad. It's going to save anyways.
So was that like formative then for you to see, go kind of at the beginning of your career, see different loops of what things hung people up, what things that maybe the designers of these products assumed would be intuitive or straightforward and maybe seemed intuitive when it was demoed to a bunch of geeks at the Macworld Expo or whatever, but then it hits the real world and then not so much. Was that, did that help inform kind of your thinking about product design?
100%. Very interesting to just work with people and sort of like see if something wasn't going to slide, sort of see like if they cared about something.
Mm.
How much does this feature matter? I thought that was really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it helped a lot then in the design practice of doing user interviews and research. You know, as I said before, right, I have an hour with these people. I maybe only see them one time. And so it's like, okay, how can I figure out very quickly, what is your goal? Why are we here? How can I help you have a satisfying time? Not just like, what am I here to talk about? Like a stump speech, but sort of that in what's that interaction between the two of us was very helpful. Because, and going forward into design, there's a lot of people you talk to internally that are like, well, the goal of this is for them to buy my product.
Right.
And it's like, well, I can't tell that to people. Like people have their own goals and we have to figure out what those are. And then, you know, map our product to that.
And if we help them achieve their goals, they'll buy the product.
Absolutely. So some of those sort of foundational things were very helpful in terms of like research and how to talk to people and how to be comfortable around people explaining things and how to get used to apologizing for technology. And that was a lot of the times, right? When you're like, well, why does it work like that? And you're like, I'm so sorry. There's three buttons at the top. One closes, one minimizes, you know, one makes a full screen, you know, trying to explain. And they're like, why would you have to hold the option to button down to do this? You're like, I don't know. That's how they decided to do it. Yeah.
Option is the one they chose. It could have been any other button, but it was that one.
Yeah. That's just what happened. So actually before that, this is what's crazy about the modern technology world is in fourth grade is when I started to learn Photoshop.
Okay.
Because there was an Adobe campus in Seattle.
Right.
And they had classes on Saturdays. And so I started taking classes. And I was there every Saturday at the Adobe campus down in Fremont.
In fourth grade.
Fourth, fifth, sixth grade. And then like LimeWire, Kazaa, you know, those like stealing things happened.
Yeah.
And so like, boom, got a copy of Photoshop until I could get one in high school, which I got through like our photography department through the Gates Foundation. I was able to like get a license like officially for Photoshop. Anyway, so I've been using Photoshop since I was in fourth grade. The whole way through.
So by the time you get your first big Silicon Valley tech job, you're designing Square's logo, and you're like, I've been doing this for 15 years,
yeah,
even though you're like 20.
Exactly. And so the first gig I did before I even went down to Square is I was working with Gus Mueller of Acorn, and at the time also Voodoo Pad.
Mm-hmm.
And I was doing his like tech support, writing documentation for like how to do Acorn stuff, you know, because I knew all the techniques from Photoshop. And I did like the Voodoo Pad icon was maybe my first actual like paid icon gig.
Right.
And then from there, I went to go work for Rogue Sheep was the name of the company. It was a bunch of ex-Adobe people. And they left Adobe. They wrote InDesign, left Adobe. And they were mostly making InDesign plugins because
right.
InDesign is actually like written on its own SDK, which is very fun.
Oh, okay.
So you can, it's very extensible. If you want to like add a column to some panel, like you can do that, which is incredible. And so we were making custom, you know, what does New York Times need for their, you know, development stack? doing sort of bespoke work in that way. So I was working with them, and then we had a little bit of like an economic downturn. People stopped investing in that way right as the iPhone SDK came out. And so we took a stab and made an iPhone app called, it was called Postage, which won an Apple Design Award. Do you remember this one, Alan? I don't know if we were hanging out at this time.
I don't know if I know. I certainly remember the time. Like, what, in retrospect, what interesting coincidence that the iPhone SDK came out around the time that that 2008 economic downturn kind of reset a bunch of people's career paths. And then there's this huge opportunity, which even then it seemed huge, but now in retrospect was way bigger than we realized happening at the same time.
Yeah, it was weird. When it was a gold rush, right? Remember there was like talk of like Trism making $1 million a day, or like flight control or whatever.
Flight
that,
control, you know? And
yeah,
Field Runners and all these those games, and also just little utilities and things. Even just like the whoever had the top search term for flashlight app and stuff like that.
Absolutely.
Back when a flashlight app was just a white screen.
Absolutely, it was a weird time for sure. And so yeah, it was in that little span that we that made an app. This app it was essentially Instagram, but you emailed the final output to people.
Right, which seemed reasonable at the time.
It did, and it was actually made before. It's so like funny to like think back at that time. We didn't have an email share sheet, so we had to like make an email server.
Oh, so it wasn't even like, because when I hear, oh, Instagram, but email, it's like, well, that way you don't have to have a server, but you still are running a server and need to do all that.
Exactly, because there was no SMS sheet that you could pop up. There was no, I mean, there was no share sheet. You could copy things to your clipboard. No, you couldn't even copy things to your clipboard. It was before the clipboard.
Right.
Yeah, so you couldn't. So we had to do all that shit. So we actually made our own mail server, and then we sort of like spoofed the from to be from you.
Oh, okay.
And we actually got a call one day because we were doing something we weren't supposed to.
That'll happen.
We were looking through your contacts, and then we were using a private API to figure out what the phone number was of the phone that you were on. And then we were looking to see who that was. And then if they had an email address, then we used that as your from. When you sent an email.
That's customer-centric design, Brad.
Right? But we got a call before that dub-dub where we won the ADA. And someone at Apple was like, how are you doing this? And we're like, I don't know. What do you mean? And like, okay, don't use private APIs, please. And so that was really funny. I mean, definitely caught us. But, you know, the reason why that app was interesting at the time was that it was like a WYSIWYG, you know, so sort of like it was a wizard, you know, there were steps, but you were making like a little postcard and you were hitting, you know, the next button, and then it was zooming around on screen and you can two finger pinch and rotate. And we had to write all that stuff custom. It was like the first app that ever had a white nav bar, because I don't know if you recall, but at the time you could tint the nav bar, but the text was always white on top of that.
Yeah, at that time you had to do it again from scratch to make it white, didn't you? Or was this another private API?
Well, yeah, I mean, maybe we didn't get caught on that one.
Okay.
Yeah, it was. But, you know, right, very interesting, like foundational stuff. The UI for it was Instagram knocked it off.
Mm-hmm.
So like you've seen the UI, you've done it. If you've ever, you know, posted a photo and there's a bottom carousel of things you can swipe between that goes between that. And it was such a different time on the iPhone because, you know, there was no one had ever done a horizontal scrolling thing before.
Right.
Yeah. You know, it was a functionality of a scroll view, but like everything scrolled vertically. Just like, you know, it was in the before times. You had a 10 megabyte download limit over cell.
Right.
You know, just a different time. It's interesting to think back at that because, I don't know, that was 2009. But so many things changed after that that would have made that product a more successful product, you know, had those changes been around then. But they weren't, you know. We didn't have in-app purchases, didn't have a mail sheet, didn't have whatever, you know, an ability to add content after the fact. People couldn't download it over a cell. People couldn't, you know, whatever, X, Y, Z. And so it's always interesting to see how technology changes in all those different ways.
One of the fundamental things that comes up when we're talking about product, either, you know, maybe if you're talking about founding or joining an early stage team, or you're talking about the really big, ambitious efforts that maybe Apple or Meta or whatever are taking on, is when is too early and when is too late for something? Like this product you're saying, like it's sounds like it was a little bit too early, or maybe it was just at the right time, but it's slightly off from maybe what Instagram did, but around the same era. And, you know, people discussing the same thing about VR or AR or whatever. It's like, oh, okay, are they too early, or are they just early enough that they're going to be in the right place to capitalize it? Do you have a sense of that there's anything you can do to try to time that, or you just try to make a really great thing and then hopefully it's early enough but not too early?
I don't know. Yeah, I was thinking about this the other day because, like, you know, when there was the Compaq and the Palm Pilot, mm-hmm. you know, all those early things before the phone, like those, there was some great software for those. People were trying to write software for it.
I built Palm Pilot apps as one of my first jobs.
You did do that. Okay. You know, I figured.
Yeah. Black and white.
But that success, you know, anyone who did have success in that industry, that didn't ladder into success on the phone. You know, all the Windows Mobile devs, that didn't ladder into success later with other things. I don't know. I mean, do you have an opinion about, like, all those things were very early, but I don't think that helped anyone at all.
It didn't help the platform people. So, like, if you're Microsoft and you were doing the pre-iPhone stuff, obviously the iPhone stuff wiped them away. I'm biased maybe on this perspective, but I feel like my time, it was formative also early, just like some of the stories you're telling. But my time working on how do I make something easy to use on a tiny screen, even though it was black and white, so it's like even more constraints than the iPhone had, mm-hmm. was helpful for me thinking about how do you build a great product on a slightly larger, slightly more detailed, but still simplified screen when the iPhone came out. But that's more about skill transfer of an individual rather than if you build a whole organization who's, and as far as I know, there's like a 99% death rate of the companies that were built around Palm Pilot products that making the transition. The company that I worked at did end up doing an iOS app, but they didn't flourish with it. Obviously, the skills of building a Code Warrior C++ Palm Pilot app didn't transfer into the next generation in the same way.
But. Yeah. So to answer your question is like, where are we? Maybe we're still in that 2004 kind of place where all these devices we have around now are the Compaq and the Palm Pilots of the world. And we're still waiting on what is this next ladder step.
I hope so. I hope that there's a next ladder step that's just going to blow things away and open it all up again. You know, Ben Thompson argues maybe no. Maybe we're at the end of those big sweeping changes that sweep away all the incumbents. But it's so much more fun when that happens.
Yeah, we'll see. It's still annoying to wear an Oculus. We'll see if the new one is better.
Everyone has their own thing. Maybe some people feel like, oh, crypto is the thing that's going to change everything or whatever, the particular technology. But I have a bit of a soft spot for the VR, AR in terms of optimism that, I mean, I don't know where it's going to be in 2 years, but in 10 years, I'm pretty optimistic about that it's going to make a big impact. I don't know if any company other than the multi-billionaire companies that are already working on it have much opportunity to be the hardware vendors, but the idea of building really compelling experiences that interact with and can enhance your day-to-day life, you know, in user-centric, people-centric ways, I don't know, that's exciting to me.
Absolutely. I think what's interesting, the part that gets me excited, in the time you're talking about working on Palm Pilot stuff and the early iPhone, we got to be inventors because no one had figured out the best way to have a spreadsheet on a Palm Pilot yet. And like, you get to figure that out. And we're doing that right now with some of the VR stuff. You know, it's like, what's the best way to edit a text document? What's the best way to edit a spreadsheet in VR? What's the best way to look at a spreadsheet?
What's the best way to move around in space? What's the best way to point at things?
Mm-hmm. We're still like figuring all those things out. And so it's very exciting. I haven't dived all the way into it because it's like the barrier to entry is a little too high. You know, it's like, I can't just bust open whatever Figma and try to like make an AR experience. It's a little bit of a harder nut to crack.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that makes it an interesting space for me is that because there's that higher barrier to entry, there's probably some opportunities that are kind of just sitting there, so to speak, that we don't have 100,000 people all simultaneously exploring product solutions to things. We have maybe thousands of people, especially when you think about non-game things. So the challenge is that, of course, that if you're going to go in and dig in to do that, you pretty much need a company around it that has some business case or pitch and probably then investor money. And so you're committing down a path of uncertainty, which it has pros and cons of going in and making a pitch of, okay, we're going to be Excel for VR or whatever it is. And if the hardware isn't there yet, it can sometimes be a difficult pitch, but it's interesting potential work for sure.
Maybe Meta will save us all. And just make the future.
Maybe. I mean, they're certainly going to try. So the title of the show is It Shipped That Way.
Mm.
not everybody will have a story that they can share of something that shipped maybe in a surprising or unfortunate way. But do you have an it shipped that way story that you can tell that maybe you learned something from or observed other people learning things?
I definitely do, but I want to rewind for a second on it shipped that way. Mm-hmm. I think there's an interesting thing. There's a few different tracks and ideas about what does it mean to ship at all. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you have an opinion about this. There's an agile approach. There's that like big quarters. So like what the Apple OS, I don't know what they're doing. You know, they have the one main ship a year.
The big yearly. And then now they're starting to kind of get a little bit more iterative where the biggest ship is once a year. But then if something is maybe threatening to risk the release, then they'll push it and have some iterative updates through the fall.
Absolutely. And Adobe moved to this model as well. And I think it's interesting now when they talk about all their product announcements at Adobe Max, which is coming up soon, I think, that they will announce features that came out 4 or 5 months ago, like they just are coming out right now because no one knew. And they'll announce features that are coming out today, and they'll announce features that are going to come out in the next 5 months. So you sort of like announce the whole year in this one moment so we can have a big marketing push. But then actually when the feature comes out, it's a little bit looser.
It kind of seems like the best of both worlds to me as a person who worked on product on huge deadlines that were unnecessarily complicated.
And I've worked some places where like one of the things that we've quote unquote shipped that changes everything is we've just dropped support for an older platform.
Sure.
You know, okay, we just dropped support for iOS 13. Oh my God. And it's like now, you know, even though we're on iOS, whatever, you know, 15, 16, it makes me, let's go back and let's watch the WWDC from iOS 14. Let's figure out all this cool shit we get to actually use now because there's a bunch of things we weren't able to do because we still had to support 13. And so you sort of have to like go back in time to be like, now we get to use whatever. You know, we get to use Grand Central Dispatch.
Woohoo!
We get to use, collection views. What? Yeah. Because we weren't able to use that before. So anyways, something's interesting in there. There's the people that ship a lot. I have found there to be a reduction in rigor around shipping.
Yes.
I will say. So if you are on this every 2 week thing, there's a lot of people I have interacted with who are like, it's fine if it's shipped that way. Mm-hmm. We'll just come back later and fix it, Brad. We don't.
And that every 2 weeks, like it goes beyond that where there's some large organizations with consumer-facing products, often ones that are a little bit lower stakes, where they're shipping multiple times a day and there's things just rolling out to production all the time and they have a whole bunch of monitoring that sort of undeploys it if the metrics start to go sideways based mm-hmm. on those things going out. And it's just there's no idea of like a version of the product is just a continual rolling thing with a whole bunch of feature flags rolling out and then a whole bunch of feature flags getting turned on for 1% or 0.01%, 1%, 10% of the people. The culture, assuming it's a low stakes enough company, like maybe a payments company wouldn't do this, but somewhere like Facebook where, you know, how bad is it if you don't see the thumbs up button rendered quite correctly on this post, that process of, oh, let's just ship it. And then if we unship it a few hours later or we refine it tomorrow, then it's probably fine.
Absolutely. I think I heard someone say one time, like, the sun never sets on Google's shipping schedule. Right? Like, they're always shipping around the world. Absolutely. And the A-B test part is another thing with, like, did it ship? Did it ship? Mm-hmm. Like, if it shipped to 1% of people, did it? Can I tweet about it?
Yeah.
And I have worked, I mean, especially in... It's so hard because there's like technology things and then sort of technology things that are social. And that has been my least favorite thing with A/B testing and shipping is like we're on a Zoom call and I'm like, oh, I have this new button. And other people are like, I don't have that button. Mm-hmm. And like now we're on the same phone call with the same app running and we have different features. And it's been a weird time and I don't like that.
Yeah, any social feature, a lot of people learn this the hard way in this sort of big boom of everyone trying to make a social network that happened a few years ago. It's now thankfully settled down a bit. But shipping anything social is just way harder than shipping most other categories of things. Like it's lower stakes in the way that you can be constantly shipping things and whatever. But because the way that users perceive the thing and interact with one another around the thing is very difficult to predict and difficult to measure for some of the reasons that you mentioned, among others, it's just really hard.
Absolutely. Do you know what the Winchester Mystery House is?
I do. But you can share, you can tell the story if you...
I mean, no, just real briefly that, you know, there's this house down in, what is it, South Bay, I think it is, here in California. It was always under construction. And also no project was sort of ever done. Or if it was done, then we'd, you know, just start a new one.
I think I know where this is going. Yes.
Yeah, you know where this is going, Alex.
Yeah, it was somebody who had become obsessed with building the home. And, you know, maybe they were not well, but they had the money to make it continuously being changed and modified, but never to any grand final design of any coherence.
Yeah. And so I had a VP of design one time come to me and say, Brad, why did this ship this way? What happened? Mm-hmm. And I was like, you don't understand. This is the Winchester Mystery House. Like, it ships because it's Wednesday, not because it's done. And that is a tough part. I think there's a big cultural mismatch around when is it time to ship? You know, when is it done? And nothing is ever done. Mm-hmm. But it does feel like in the world, there are a lot more things that are less done being shipped than maybe there once was because of the internet.
That definitely seems true.
Absolutely. And so it sounds like, I mean, did you ever do Box software?
Yeah. I worked, for example, on iWork when I was at Apple, and it needed to go on a CD in a box. And there was a date that we all knew. If this commit was not made by this day, it wasn't going in the box. It would be on the shelves in the Apple store.
Absolutely. And so like the sort of the barrier for like, well, it just shipped that way, you know, is... It's got to be higher, right? The quality bar has got to be way higher because we cannot come back later and patch this. It's so expensive.
But it is also incredibly expensive to all the process that we had and the more waterfall, and of course nobody would call it waterfall because it's known to be the bad way, but like the more the waterfall style mentality around the cutoff dates and the way the QA worked and the way that things got implemented in that cycle was all driven by that it has to hit this bar on this day to be on in a box, which, like you say, it resulted in higher quality on that day, but it also resulted in a whole bunch of trade-offs, a whole bunch of things. Prices were paid in order to achieve that.
Absolutely. So there's like, you know, it shipped this way. Why did it ship this way? And then there's the other part of that, which is like, crap, it shipped this way. And how are we going to fix it? Mm-hmm. Sort of like, how do you go around the other direction? And so like, I think the most popular phrase ever is like, oh, you shipped your org chart.
Mm-hmm.
You hear that all the time.
Yep.
Right? And so it's, okay, it's one thing to ship your org chart. And then now it's another thing to be like, okay, now that we have shipped our org chart, now what do we do about that? And it's harder to put that genie back in the bottle.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, Microsoft was like, I think the first company that was started to become infamous for its org chart being visible in its software. But it, for more complicated companies, that happens more and more. Do you have a sense of that? And like, maybe this is a little bit beyond, or I'm not sure how involved you've been in organizational design, but for founders and leaders and people who are leading product orgs and tech companies in general, how you design your org chart is a super complicated, extremely important question. Do you have a sense, like, do you think of when those questions come up that you should be designing the org chart partially to work with a product, the product consequences that it'll have in mind? Or is it more design the org chart that makes sense for running an effective organization and then make sure your product orgs can not let the shape of the org chart mean that, okay, we have two tabs and the tabs are effectively this team and that team?
Well, first off, Alan, let me just tell you, no one knows what they're doing. Nobody nobody. Like, I've talked to all of them. I've been doing it long. I think you and I have been doing it longer for a lot of the people that are out here tasked with making that decision, and they don't know. What I have noticed that I think we don't give enough respect to is that every problem space is different and then requires a different thing. So even though we're all under this bucket of like technology, I'm a technology company. It's like if you are a healthcare company or you're a fintech company or you're a game company or you are a rideshare company, like all those things are fundamentally different in how you must organize the company. Mm-hmm. And so it's tough to just be like, well, a tech company must have a combined DevOps team and you must have this kind of design team. It's not clear enough because there's so many different problems. And the other big one that I've noticed people run into is like, how big is the problem space that you're working on? You have a product company like, I'll use Apple as an example, only in that they have a bunch of different services to work on. So you have like Sticky Notes app and the Text Edit app and Pages.
The
and
two
numbers,
most popular apps.
I know. Yeah. Just rattling them off here. So you have all these different like places to worry about. That may require a different structure than a company that only has one app.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so I think my favorite example recently, and I recommend everyone go just take a peek at this, is the logged out Airbnb website.
Okay.
Which just has, they've redesigned it, I don't know, in the last year or two. It just has, it's just very focused and it's very clear. And it feels like, because you know, it's one product, it feels like one team made it.
Mm.
It has a clarity of thought that it is communicating about what the product is that feels like they didn't ship their org chart. Or it feels like a team of very, like 12 very skilled people made it.
So just for people who don't like quickly pull it up, what I've loaded it here and I see, I'm in a product experience. I'm not. It's not a splash page where it's like, click here for businesses, click here for hosts, but click here for whatever. And like, you know, the stereotypical big, if you go to a really large company, often you see this basically the org chart on a page and then mm-hmm. you navigate to, they ask you to figure out what category of thing that you are. Are you a business under 50 employees or whatever? Instead, what this Airbnb logged out experience is a list of different categories of things that you might, sort of Airbnbs that you might want at along the top. And then for me, a grid of beautiful Airbnbs that are appealing and reasonable distance, like a day's trip away from where I am today. Mm-hmm. And it's really compelling. It's like I've gone into the product. I immediately understand what this thing is rather than a splash page with cartoon people looking at me.
Exactly. And if you tap on the hamburger icon up to the right, look at how short that menu is.
Oh man, that must have been a huge debate to make. There's 5 items. Log in, sign up, host your home, hosting experience, help. And that's it. And there's 40 more things I'm sure that they could. It's a big enough company. There's so many other things. Someone's like, well, we need to have this or we should have this. And can we have this in there?
That's right. And so how do you, and this changes if you log in, if you're a host, if you're a guest. Once it knows more about you, then, you know, more buttons start to come up. You know, there's ways to get sort of deeper into the site. But just like, I don't know, are you shocked when you look at that? Like, oh my gosh, how did an organization of, I don't know how big the company is now, you know, 5,000 people, like how were they able to, across all those teams, come to this clear of a thought about what they do and not ship their org chart? They didn't let 1,000 flowers bloom. It's just so focused that it's beautiful in this interesting way.
Yeah, interesting that you mentioned. I mean, I am very impressed in it. My instinct, which is maybe it shows maybe some of my biases, is that they have one or a small group of strongly respected and good at communicating product leaders that have driven this and have used some political capital in the company to make sure that happened, mm-hmm. Which at the top, if not like the CEO level, rather than where you tend to, the stereotype is it, you grow to a certain size that you end up having someone who's not a really intuned to the product at the top layer or two, and they're more sort of MBA style, not, you know, there's some very competent and successful product thinkers that have MBAs, but someone whose primary way of looking at the world is the MBA style of, okay, well, I have this org chart and I'm going to let the people in the org chart do the things that they do. And I'm not going to go in and tell everybody, all right, this is the main core thing of the product and everyone needs to fall in line behind it. That's my instinct. I don't know if you have any.
No, that you nailed it. And so the CEO of Airbnb went to the Rhode Island School of Design, RISD. So here he's going to come with sort of a design expertise, exactly to your point. And then I'll compare that with I worked for Target for a while. And
right. So not the CEO of Target, not a designer?
Not a designer. They are a Fortune 5 company or whatever, right? They're real big up there. And they're a large organization. So their CEO operates more like a venture capitalist than he does that kind of thing. So like we had a disagreement. So you know, the org that I was working through laddered up through the chief product officer to the CEO. And I had a disagreement with the marketing team and they laddered up through the CMO to different people. Couldn't come to an agreement because the CEO wasn't going to be the judge to break that tie
right.
in the middle. He's just like—
Because who were they to make that decision? You know, they're not the expert on that.
I'm just here to fund you guys. Yeah.
Yeah.
I can stop funding you. I mean, uh-huh. Right? So it's just a totally different way of looking at it. And the thing we were arguing about was at the time there was 2 different logins. So if you used one of the apps that the marketing team made, they had one login. And if you used an app that the product team made, target.com, they had a different login.
I would be so mad.
It's a very fundamental, like, obviously you shouldn't have 2 different logins for Target properties, right? Obviously.
Oh man, my bones hurt just even hearing the idea of trying, I'm going to try to convince someone that was bad and should not be. Oh man.
Exactly. And so you had on the product side, we felt like that should be our job, is to maintain your identity. On the marketing side, they're like, yeah, but we have way more users and we're getting users faster. But the reason why they had more users and they were getting users faster is that they spend money. So like they were spending, you know, whatever, 30, I don't know what the number was, you know, $30 a pop on a head, and we're relying on organic growth. And so like, you know, what is the number? What is it worth? How much did it cost us to get there? Whatever. Just some other people needed to make this decision. What ended up happening, what ended up breaking the tie was Travis Kalanick got kicked out of Uber, and the CMO of Target went to Uber to replace him.
Oh, okay.
And was promptly, he only lasted a few months in the job before the current CEO of Uber came back in. But in that sort of power vacuum, it was like, great, okay, now marketing, you don't have this anymore. This one guy who was preventing it, that roadblock moved away. And so like because of an org change, then the product changes as a result.
Yeah, which happened to have a good effect in that case, which is that, okay, now there's a sanity in that if you're logging into Target, you don't have to know if you're targeting which org you're logging into, the product org or the marketing org. But it could have gone the other way. Like if the folks championing on your side happened to change orgs, then maybe the marketing side would have won the day. And then, you know, however many years later, there still would be two logins. Mm-hmm. And there would be maybe a whole paragraph saying, if you have a login at targetmarketing.com or whatever, marketing.target.com, then click here.
Oh my gosh. Exactly. Exactly. So I do have like a war story slightly, just an interesting one about shipping. It shipped that way.
Okay.
Which is there was at Lyft, when I started there, someone who was a designer before me was like, hey, you know, I was working on this project. I updated how the cars look top down in the map view. I have new assets. He was a 3D designer. He's like, I don't know how to do this. So here's the files. Can you make them into assets? And so sort of like first, second week on the job, I made those into assets. They shipped in the app 4.5 years later.
Whoa. Okay.
And you'd think an asset swap, right? How hard could that be?
It seems really easy, hardly an inconvenience.
Right? But the problem, okay, first roadblock was, I don't want to build the assets that way. I'm like, okay. You know, so I looked, let me see, give me exactly what the assets are. I'll make them the exact same size. We'll do an asset swap. It's going to be great. Hit that up. And then the next problem we hit was that the assets in app were cached. And there was no expiration on the cache.
Okay.
So if you had the app already, then it would just never change. And so then right. All of a sudden, this little project that seemed like an asset swap, now all of a sudden it got sort of tied, and I didn't care that much. It's not like I was pushing to get these assets in.
No, it's not like you were working full-time for 4 years.
No, I'm not working full-time for 4.5 years on these assets. So now all of a sudden, this asset swap, sort of Jira task or whatever, sort of gets embedded inside this larger one, which is a caching issue.
Right, changed caching, which is famously an easy problem for software engineers, caching and naming things.
Very easy, exactly. And so then it gets put in a roadmap, but then that team gets reallocated to this, and then it moves over here, and that team gets disbanded, and so this little task just sort of stayed in that Jira, and it moved around for just an insane amount of time before it actually ended up happening. So it happened before I started there. I worked there for about 4 years, and it didn't ship until after I left, was the full span of that insanity for what should be an asset swap. And so it's organizational. It's, you know, obviously there's an easy way to change it, which is just to give it a new URL, and then you don't have to worry about that. Whatever, there's other ways around it. They weren't taken. It didn't matter that much. Otherwise, I would have made people do it. But it's just sort of, it was interesting to me, how hard is it to do a simple thing? And sometimes as a designer, some of the things that I want changed can be like, I need that background color changed. Like that status bar is the wrong gray. Mm-hmm. You know, these are really minor changes. And in larger organizations, the way that they want it to work is like, well, I file a Jira and then we go to sprint planning and then we advocate for our bug and then it doesn't go above the line. And then we do it again the next week and we keep sort of arguing. And if we keep caring, then we'll keep arguing and then eventually let me get above the line. And if you stop caring, well, then it didn't really matter. That's sort of the thought. But it's frustrating for me because I just want to change it. And I feel like it should be easier. And I think my biggest sort of frustration with where we are today with tools for iOS and Android development is that it's too difficult for me to do it. It's too difficult. Like either it's a company policy that I'm not allowed to have code editing access, which is true in a lot of places, or it's just that the tools are too hard to communicate, you know, too hard to get into actual code. And it feels like there should be an Apple app and an Android dev app that is designed for designers to make the app look better. And so I don't have to file a bug because the color's off by one hex value. I should just be able to change that when I see it. Or like I was working on a project and we had written it in its website in React and there was a typo on it. And it was like a 4-day change to fix the typo because it was a React app. And we had to, I don't know, do a bunch of bullshit. And it's like, it's a website. We should just be able to, you know, change it so easily. And so I think it's interesting how your dev stack and the requirements of that will sort of inhibit you from even doing things easily. It's something that is interesting to me.
Yeah, you hit on a couple of really interesting things. One is this sort of axiom, which you don't hear discussed as much in smaller companies at least, but as companies grow, you start to hit on it, which is that the more people need to be involved and have sign off and have process in order to make an improvement, the fewer improvements you're going to end up getting, right, in terms of quantity. And so there's a whole bunch of things you can do to try and improve that. And maybe we've already touched on some of the organizational things that you can use to hinder and or maybe potentially help if you design them well. But in terms of the tooling, you mentioned the idea of Apple having an app that you can tweak those things. And Apple does have tools in Xcode and things like that you can, if you do everything in the pure Apple way that they advise, you can go in and you can change a color value and it'll get propagated across the whole app. But the challenge in large organizations, certainly at the scale of something like a Lyft or Airbnb or something like that, is that typically those apps both have existed since before Apple provided that tool. Mm-hmm. And they are in a large design system that has an entire team in charge of the design system that is in charge of specifying down the hex value that then gets ingested into some system that goes into somewhere because they want to have some coherence and consistency across their entire design system, which in theory would allow a change to happen and propagate through everything to change one hex value. But then when you're at the paper cut level where you're, okay, I am feeling this tiny pain on this one screen, on this toolbar, and the problem is that this text value isn't correct, then those sort of design systems, which in theory allow change to be easier and faster, can sometimes make it more difficult for an individual change to get implemented, because then sometimes the Jira ticket turns into this big katamari of a whole bunch of unrelated things.
Absolutely.
So I think that the tooling thing you can't just blame on Apple because they've done some to their part, but I think it's something that there needs to be, or I'm curious about your thought on this, but it seems to me is something that should be an organizational priority for product orgs to be investing a certain percentage of their time into tooling that helps the people that are finding these small product improvements that are worth making to be able to make those with fewer organizational hurdles and fewer people that need to get involved and fewer people's Jira tickets need to be, or fewer meetings need to happen in order to make improvements, assuming that they actually are, in fact, improvements.
100%. So as a, you know, here I am talking to an engineer. I have made sort of that my life's work. I'm a designer. I'm not an engineer, but having a really, really good relationship with engineers, talking about every problem that's coming up. If I get sort of a top-down directive that I now have to communicate to the engineer and they're like, that's dumb, I try to make sure that I can explain it really well, that I listen to their feedback because I'm the messenger and they are having feedback about how dumb that feature is, mm-hmm. that they're being asked to build. And making sure that I keep that relationship really tight, because the easiest way to change that status bar color is just to be like, hey, Alan, can you just change that real fast? far and away the best way to get anything done. The time that it takes you to do something may have just been like you would have been staring off into space anyways. I mean, there is like a lot of flex time.
You're waiting for your next meeting or whatever.
Exactly. There is flex time in the day. And so if you get excited about something, like, dude, let's stay like 30 minutes late today and let's get like a Lottie animation in. So this thing like does a cool animation. You know, and if you can get the dev you're working on excited about that, then it feels like that's actually, I think, the best way to make good product is to do that in a smaller way. Let the people above you be like, well, it's only a 5% allocation toward bug fixes and dark mode things this month. You know, you're like, that's cool. You keep having fun talking about that. And then now that we're down here, like, we're going to make some great software.
If you get excited about something is a great maxim, and I think that scales too. Like, you're talking about it on the one-on-one level of if you can get that good relationship with people that are your dyads or your pairs to be actually implementing the thing, or on the other side designing the thing, then that's super helpful. But if you can get excited about something as a group at any scale, that seems to be when the really great stuff happens.
Yes. Now, I want to take a brief, just to mention, is the Mythical Man Month. Do you know that?
Mm.
That parable?
Oh, yeah. Famous that adding more people can make it slower rather than making it faster.
Dude, totally. And so, like, one thing when we were talking about Airbnb, right, where I was like, look at this clarity of thought. That's what I was saying, right? It looks so like everyone was on the same page when they were working on this. That's how it feels. Mm-hmm. Part of the Mythical Man Month is like they like broke out, you know, an equation, which is like you have to, everyone has to talk to each other.
Yeah.
And so like the more people you add, the harder it is to have a shared understanding of what we're doing here.
Yeah.
And I think that is sort of the biggest problem that I've seen. And I don't know how to solve it. And I'm not here to. I know that there's some people who are like, understand that problem. And so because of that, they limit their team to 12 people. You know, or they limit their team to, right? You have that. How many people work for you?
Yeah, we're 16 right now, but we're not working all 16 people all on the same product. When we're doing, we're often working and building out products where we have maybe 4 people building that thing. And every single person knows everything about the product and they all know each other. And there's very little of this web of communication that you're talking about across that product.
Absolutely. And a lot of it comes from a lack of organization. And I think there's even like a lack of desire to even organize in the, I call it the Bay Area process for product development, which is like, let's just get some smart people and throw them in a room and they'll figure it out. And that works to a certain extent. But if you have, you know, 5,000 quote unquote smart people in a room, they're just going to come out with a different idea for like which direction to row. And so that's, I think that's just like an interesting like problem. I heard a fun one the other day, which was A people hire B people and B people hire C people. But the thing they don't mention is how many people they hire. They hire so many C people.
It's a lot easier to hire a whole bunch of people if you have a lower bar. I never really thought about that, but if you talk to really talented people, often they one of the things they'll complain about is that they've interviewed so many people and they're having trouble hiring their open recs to like they have headcount that they can fill, but they're struggling to fill it. And then sometimes you talk to other people and they're like, "Yeah, I just hired 20 people this week, and I don't know, everyone seemed good to me."
The way you go, yeah. I work with some people that only work with contractors. And so, like, you know, their company is only 2 or 3 people. Because then everyone else is, you know, a team of 6 in Russia that are doing the development or, you know, whatever they're using for the different parts of their labor. But the thing that I love, why I enjoy working for them sometimes, is that because they sort of choose to work with contractors, they have to be so organized with what they're doing. And they really spend a lot of time being like, okay, we need to figure out what we think ahead of time. And then we hire people and then they execute on that instead of being like, yeah, can you guys just like, I don't know, make an app or something? You know, like it's just like a difficult thing to do. And so I feel like I've worked in a lot of orgs where we've sort of scaled so big that it's difficult to keep everyone on the same page or nay, impossible. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
When I was at Square, the way that we tried to help that, and I think it was helpful, was there was like an all hands company meeting every Friday for like 2 hours.
Oh, wow.
I mean, it's like, it was like a lot of people. I got it down to an hour when I was there. But, you know, it's here's everything that we shipped. Here's all these things that we're thinking about. And there was like a dedicated time for the CEO to talk every week, a dedicated time for the COO to talk every week about, you know, numbers and where the company is. Now here we can all be on the same page. And so that was sort of the intent of that meeting. And I think that that was helpful for sure.
We do that at 16, well, not 2 hours, we do half an hour. But every Friday, give an update. Here's the interesting things. Give a bit of chance of team bonding, which obviously, you know, 5,000 people on a call doesn't get team bonding. But having a heartbeat of communication and alignment, they, you know, they famously say one of the most difficult things, if not the most difficult thing of running a large org, is keeping everyone pulling in the same direction. Not figuring out which direction to pull in, which is also hard, but even just getting everyone to pull in any given direction that is more or less the same as one another.
Absolutely. And the, I hate to say the word politics of it, but like the amount of people who are like, yeah, yeah, that person's telling you to do this, but they don't know what they're talking about.
Mm.
Like, listen to me and like, you should pull this direction. There's just a lot of that. And it's natural and it's difficult. And I don't know if there's a way to solve that. I think it's just you sort of get tired of it and then you decide to go work for a smaller company.
There's ways to disincentivize it and there's ways to incentivize it. I think that's a little bit out of the scope of the show, but I think that to what degree companies and leaders work on disincentivizing or just not avoiding incentivizing that kind of politics also tends to correlate with good product outcomes, in my observation, obviously.
Yeah. The other thing is it feels like you can just sort of like smell that a company's org chart is to let 1,000 flowers bloom.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to think of a good example. I think maybe a good example is the Disneyland website.
Oh.
Where you're like, okay, what do they need to do I don't know. Pop that one up, Alan.
I'm going to bring it up here. Let's see what we got.
Bring it up. Bring it up.
I also, okay, first, before anything, the URL is disneyland.disney.go.com. Like, they still haven't given up on go.com.
Yep. Right. Okay. We're starting off with, there is a lack of clarity.
Uh-huh. There is a lot going on. I've got a giant video. One of the biggest buttons on the thing is play full video, learn more holidays. And then there's a relatively way more complicated than the Airbnb control that did the same thing. Airbnb had a very nice compact control for saying get started to find your trip. But the Disneyland one is much more complicated. And then a whole bunch of other kind of things, places to stay, things to do, Magic Key, which of course I go to Disneyland from time to time and it's great, but I don't know what that means. And a bunch of other stuff all around. A link to say visit Disney.com is the very top left thing because I'm going to go to Disneyland website in order to then go to the general Disney website. That's, talk about org chart.
Yes, right? So much more confusing things. And actually, you mentioned that Magic Key thing where it's like, what are these words that we're making our customers need to understand in order to use our product? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, at Airbnb, it's like, okay, it's a listing or a house or a trip. You know, the words are sort of, you know, carefully thought through, but I think they're actually like a lot more easy to understand. I don't know, you know, everyone has their own words. So right now, Disneyland, they've just gone into confusing town. So you mentioned the Magic Key. There's actually four different. What the Magic Key is an annual pass or it's a membership.
Oh, I didn't realize. If I hover on these things, the parks and tickets, places to stay, things to do, they explode out giant like 2001 era like drop down menus with like dozens of things in each menu.
Oh my gosh, it's just so much to read. So like of the Magic Keys, then which is the annual pass, then there's four of them, and they are called the Believe Key, the Enchant Key, the Imagine Key, and the Inspire Key. Now, what do those mean? I don't know. You know, like, which one's the best? You know, you got to go read up and learn. So, like, what's the amount of stuff that you need to, like, learn? And if you're looking at this page, it's like, oh my God, what is a Genie Plus pass, and how does that affect my Lightning Lane Park Hopper magic ticket thing? You know, it's, right? There's, like, so much you need to, like, grok. And, like, so the first, once they introduced all these new terms, I hadn't gone and it was closed for the pandemic and I went. And I was like, there's so many new terms that I'm literally just going to, like, today, while I'm at this park, just let this all wash over me and try to understand what all the words are. And it sort of took me a day to be like, okay, well, the Genie Plus gets you Lightning Lanes, except for these four rides, which require an additional fee, but you can only get two of those per park, per day, one per ride. You know, trying to like understand all like this way that the system works, and it's difficult. And I like that because that's what I do for a living. But it's too much to put on people.
Yeah. I mean, you can see how it evolves over time, right? Someone's given a goal, which is extract as much money for a guest as possible, right? And then, you know, when you are looking at the status quo, how do you do that without adding more moving parts?
Yes. I think one of the hardest things for everyone to deal with is we look at our product for, you know, it's where I work and I get my paycheck and I'm there for 40 hours a week and I'm staring at the screens. And so I think you can sort of like trick yourself into thinking that everyone else is doing that too. And actually when you look at like your usage patterns, you know, how many times are people going to be using this in a month? You know, four times for a total of 3 minutes.
Yeah.
You know, now given that time and that they have a task to accomplish, how much are they able to learn in that span? This sort of cuts both ways because on one hand, you have things like an e-commerce website. So I get an ad from Instagram to buy some sunglasses. I'm only ever going to be on that website one time. So like, please don't call your cart something weird. Because I just need to, I'm only going to be here one time.
It's your, add these glasses to your journey.
Exactly. And so for those things, I can't learn anything. And there's another side of it where it's like, okay, it's Microsoft Word. I'm going to be in here for the next 40 years. Then I do have the ability to like learn things. And maybe I don't today know how exactly how track changes works, but like I can learn how it works and that learning will be useful to me. And so like it's okay to learn. And there's sort of just the spectrum in between, which is like how much is it okay to teach my users? When is it the right time for them to learn about this? And maybe your app, so like at Lyft, right? It's like, it's hard to learn, or like Uber, right? Those two things. It's hard to learn anything because like when you're using the app, you need to use it now.
Like yeah, it's you're not, in time pressure situation 100% of the time. Otherwise, the app's not open.
Exactly. And so please don't make me teach things. And one of the sort of rants that I go on all the time that I compare between is there's a difference between a tool and an experience, sort of at these different ends. Everyone's sort of in between. But if you think about it, on one side, a tool is like, it's a flashlight and it turns on. And so that's what we're making, and we need some batteries and whatever. And, you know, we have a set of requirements to make this tool. On the other side of that, you have the concept of illumination.
Okay, yeah.
This is what our product is about illuminating a room, not about you need a flashlight. And so, okay, because that's our company's goal, so we're going to make floor lamps and table lamps and things that glow and diffusion lenses and different ways of dialing, whatever. You know, it's because your mission is, like, much bigger. And I think a lot of the VC, larger companies, et cetera, I think they push people toward that other end of it, which is, like, solve a really big problem with your product.
Yeah. You have to get our $1 billion a return.
Exactly. And so that's sort of this tension that I've seen from people. People that are like, I just want to make a tool. I just want to go to Airbnb.com and I want to click a listing and I just want to get a goddamn house. And then other people who are trying to push you more toward the, like, just be more like, it's about an experience. And, like, just give me loose dates and, like, let's do a lot of reading. And, you know, so there's just a push and pull between those two different things. And I've seen a lot of people get into fights about that. Like, what are we here for? Is it just a tool? Just show them the buttons and let them figure it out. Or should it be like a really guided wizard where you're clicking, you know, one button per screen and it's taking you down a tree?
And that seems to bring us really perfectly, I feel, full circle to your original story at the beginning of the episode about being in front of users, using something from the first time is often, I feel, and tell me how you feel about this, is like can be an antidote for that thinking that you can throw 100 things at them. Like if you're 5 steps removed from the people that have actually done any user research or actually seen people use the product, it's easier to delude yourself into thinking that someone wants a 10-minute wizard. But if you, maybe that's the antidote to some of that thinking is okay, your punishment for proposing this extremely complicated org chart as a screen is that you need to do 5 user researching interviews and see people encounter this for the first time.
Yes. Or like we're going to go to like some timeshare style thing and I need you to present to a room of 30 people how all of the magic key systems work.
Yeah. And we've determined that they have an attention span of 9 minutes for this, so you have 9 minutes.
You have 9 minutes. And then you're not going to talk to them after. You just present, and then when they leave, I'm going to ask them. I'm going to take a quiz. I'm going to see if they understood what you were talking about in that amount of time.
And that's your quarterly KPI.
That is how I wish. Yeah, because design, right, it's like design stuff. You know, I'm a low level, whatever. Design often gets pegged at this low level. Like, what color is the button? But, right, it happens all the way through the stack of, like, what is the API that you're designing? What is, you know, what comes back in that request? You know, what is the service we're designing? How complicated is it? How easy is it, right? There's sort of all these different levels of it. And it feels like sometimes people are poorly designing at that higher level, thinking that they're not designers. And that's the part that bugs me the most. And it's been true forever. You read a book that was written in the 50s and they're complaining about the same things just with industrial design and making belts. You know, these problems are sort of eternal, sadly.
Yeah, well, if we're lucky, then we'll see examples like Airbnb where design thinking from the top leads to businesses succeeding. And then if it really doesn't have the impact that both of us think that it does, the evolutionary pressure will lead to more success for those products. And the ones that just chip their chart into a giant basket of random junk on the homepage will have evolutionary pressure to stop doing that. And over time, hopefully as an industry, we will at least get somewhat better at trying to advocate for that user-centric kind of way of thinking.
That's the hope. Hopefully we can get there.
Well, our guest today has been Brad Ellis. Thank you so much for joining me. And excited to see what you build next. We should have you back at some point because I feel like there's a whole bunch of threads that we could pull on and dig into more.
100%. Thanks so much, Alan. You have a great rest of your day.
Yeah, you too.
I'll talk to you later.
It Shipped That Way is brought to you by Steam Clock Software. If you're a growing business, your customers need a really nice mobile app, get in touch with Steam Clock.